Norman Finkelstein is an American political scientist and author who has written extensively on the Israeli-Palestine conflict. So, nothing controversial at all about this episode of Dunk Tank. Before I play the interview, I wanted to explain a little bit why I wanted to have this guy on the show. Basically, he had been denied tenure at DePaul, and he, even though the faculty approved his tenure, and the university board revoked it, and it was because, we get into this on the show, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but it was because this guy, Alan Dershowitz, who's a Harvard Law professor, and who Norman Finkelstein had kind of exposed, got really mad and sent a bunch of letters to the school accusing him of all kinds of crazy nonsense, and it wound up ruining his career. And I felt some empathy for the guy, because anyone who knows me knows that when I was in high school, I wrote this speech about the injustices of our private Catholic high school, and it's a long story, but basically one of our classmates had committed suicide the summer before our senior year, and in Catholicism, that's a big sin, and the administration just really played their hand poorly and upset a lot of students in the process. And so I wrote this speech for our English class, and I thought I was, you know, I was attacking the beast, but it turns out I was just like a fly that the beast flicked away out the window. I don't know. I think the people who try to fight for the truth as they see it to be brought into the world, and then are sort of blacklisted, I think those people deserve a platform, or at least an opportunity to explain themselves. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is my interview with Norman Finkelstein. All right, I am here with Norman Finkelstein. Thanks so much for being on the show.
You're welcome.
So I wanted to start off just to sort of frame this conversation, because you're a very, just based on my conversations with you so far, just a very mild-mannered guy. But you've also managed to kick up a lot of dust in your academic career. And I want people to understand the sacrifices that you've made. And I had first heard of you after what happened to you at DePaul, when the faculty voted to grant you tenure, but the university board voted against you. The person who spearheaded this effort to get you off campus is now Donald Trump's favorite TV lawyer, Alan Dershowitz. And he had a vendetta against you because you had exposed him for plagiarism in his book. Could you talk a little bit about what that experience was like for you?
Well, first of all, I want to correct you on what may appear to be a semantical point, but I still feel it warrants, let's call it amendment, not correction. I've not had an academic career. I was never really part of academia except for a relatively brief period at DePaul University. I got my PhD in 1988 from the Princeton University Politics Department, and from 1988 until 2000, I was an adjunct. An adjunct is the equivalent of a substitute teacher. You get hired and rehired every 6 months. There's no contract. You get paid between, at that time, $2,500 and $3,000 a course, which meant my annual income was about $25,000, which even in New York was barely livable. Actually, $25,000 would be in the high end for various reasons not worth going into. I was paid less than a McDonald's worker, not to diminish the difficulty of their work, but just to say
of course
that I wasn't an academic by professionally. At DePaul University, I had a visiting professorship for 2 years It was then converted to a tenure, what's called a tenure track line. And then I was denied tenure in 2007. And from 2007 until today, except for one brief teaching stint in Turkey, and just this past semester, one semester at Hunter College in New York, I've been unemployed and unemployable, that is to say. There is no position for which I apply. Actually, even jobs I've sought to volunteer for. For example, I wanted to volunteer to teach in a good charter school in East Harlem. People wouldn't even accept me as a volunteer because nowadays you no longer provide references. People just examine your profile, your Google profile, and because there are literally tens of thousands of websites which claim I'm a Holocaust denier, and an equal number of websites or more which claim I'm a supporter of terrorism, in particular the Hezbollah and the Hamas, I've not been able to get work. So I can't say I have had an academic career. Actually, the truth be told, I've not had a professional career. I only worked in my adult life at a steady job, except when I was working on my doctoral dissertation, where I did have a steady job. I wrote my doctoral dissertation in the mornings and at nights before work and after work. I was not employed most of my adult life. And you could see it in my Social Security statement, where there are many years where they send you every several years a full reckoning of your Social Security, of your income over since you became a bona fide member of the working class. And there are a large number of years where it's zero.
Okay, so I guess the short answer is that it really sucked. No, but what's so crazy when people call you a Holocaust denier is that your parents were in the Holocaust. You know, you had family who did not survive. And the idea that those two things would go together is just wild. And I heard Noam Chomsky point to you as, you know, in other countries, maybe academics might might get, you know, shot or something like that. And in America, they might just never be able to work again. So obviously it sounds like a potentially very embittering experience. But what I thought was interesting about you is that you sort of kept, you never, despite that, swerved from your line. I believe it was while you were in grad school, you had, and this is kind of a good starting point to go into the founding of Israel. You would expose this book From Time Immemorial, which was it was a bestseller at the time, which basically claimed that, you know, there were never any Palestinians, and Israel was basically founded on open territory. So, you know, it's all a wash. It doesn't really matter. When you went through and basically looked at all the footnotes and sort of exposed that this was, you know, this was not true at all. What happened when you sent that information out into the world?
Well, we have to have a little bit of context. I was just a graduate student. I was a nobody. And important people don't read stuff by nobodies unless they have some sort of pedigree. Let's say if I had signed my letter, Jared Kushner. Given his pedigree, people pay attention because he's got money and he's got power. I was just an obscure, or more than obscure, graduate student, and nobody paid attention. But I've always, I sent it to 25 people on the left, personalities who I thought, judging from their public commitments to justice for the Palestinians, would find my scholarship research of some interest. And I've always regarded it as indicative of Professor Chomsky's democratic sensibility. that he was the only one that replied. He read what I wrote, said he found it convincing, and urged me, encouraged me to continue the research and see what else I would come up with. He's one of the few people who doesn't judge you by your pedigree. He judges you by your product. He looks past the awards and all the rest, and just evaluates things on their content. And that's unusual. Now, part of it is because he's so he's like Gulliver and Lilliputia. And so a Harvard degree or a community college degree, from his heights, he can barely make out the distinction. But it's also true he's unusual as a scholar, because he does have the capacity to focus just on the content with no attention or heed given to the person or the credentials of the person who's submitting their research for assessment.
Okay, so that he was one of the few people who basically responded, and otherwise...
He was the only person
who responded. And otherwise, it didn't really gain any traction. But that's a good starting point when we talk about the founding of Israel. Because as I said, I know you had parents who survived the Holocaust, and the idea, as I understand it, behind Israel's founding was that this would at last be a safe Jewish homeland. How is that what it wound up being, or how did Israel come into being?
I think that's a little bit too complicated a question for a telephone interview.
Okay.
I would say that the Nazi Holocaust, whether you agree with people's interpretation or not, I'm not going to say whether it's right or wrong. I'm just going to say a large number of people, both Jewish and those sympathetic to Jews, reached the conclusion that Jews needed, if not a state, they did need a refuge, a place to which they can flee in times of persecution, because the feeling was that the world closed its borders on the Jews at the very moment where they desperately needed a place to which they could take flight because of the persecution. So certainly the Nazi Holocaust did play a role in public opinion and in the way people now viewed how to resolve the problem of anti-Semitism and what was called back then the Jewish question.
Okay, and maybe I'll try to make these questions more to the point. So the 1967 war led to Israel taking more territory at the conclusion of that war. And their defense minister at the time, and later their prime minister, said that, quoting, "We have to be honest with ourselves. Just because Egypt had tanks on its border doesn't necessarily mean they wanted to attack. We chose to attack." Is there a brief way of explaining why they would wanted to have started a war?
Well, Israel had two goals. You would call it a major goal and a primary goal and a subordinate goal. The primary goal was Israel wanted and has wanted to dominate the region, to control the region, to be the regional hegemon. In part, it's because of this feeling of Jewish superiority, and also the flip side of that, which is contempt for the Arabs. And therefore, Jews, by virtue of being Jews, have title to be the regional hegemon. but also the belief that the Arab Muslim world would never accept a Jewish state implanted in its midst, forcibly implanted in its midst, and therefore the Israeli state would have to do everything within its power to repress any aspirations of the Arab Muslim world to enter into the modern world. And at that point, the main challenge to Israel was posed by Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian head of state, the president of Egypt, whose goal was to modernize the Arab world. And Israel then, and still does, wants to keep the Arab world backward, keep the Arab world enthrall to the dictators and various other despots. Then as now, Israel has always been aligned with the most retrograde forces in the region, and also with the United States, which on a global level wants to be the hegemon and has successfully been so since World War II. So it sought a war as a way, and it proved to be successful, to defeat Nasser, to defeat the tendency that he represented. Not that in practice there was much to it, but he represented a tendency that which was to modernize the Arab world, and modernize the Arab world basically meant in Nasser's time to secularize it and also to economically develop it and also to loosen the hold that the various reactionary, feudal, medieval elements, the stranglehold they had over the societies in the Middle East. Now things changed. They successfully rid themselves of Nasser. He became a nullity after the June 67 war. But then a new challenge arose in 1979 with the Islamic Revolution, which has, you know, it's a hybrid. It has retrogressive elements, but Iran is a very impressive place economically, culturally. It can't be disregarded. And now Israel is, once it freed itself of the radical nationalist threat, it fairly quickly then faced a new threat, a radical fundamentalist threat. And so now it wants to do to Iran what it did to Egypt in 1967.
And there's been recent escalation between the U.S. and Iran, and it looks like we've been, you know, steps away from potentially war with Iran. How much of that has to do with the goals you mentioned?
I think that is the goal, but there is a feeling, especially after the I think that is the goal, but there is a feeling that Iran is not a walkover, and after the debacle in Iraq, there was a decision made by ruling elites, including the U.S., that the answer to Iran is not to destroy it, but to try to come to some sort of modus vivendi with it. And that was the agreement that was drawn up between the 5+1, the Security Council members plus Germany and Iran. But Netanyahu and elements of the Trump administration, people like Bolton and Pompeo, they're still of the old school. You can't reach a modus vivendi with these regimes. You have to take out the big stick and cracked their skull.
Yikes. Moving back just a little bit to what at least publicly we think of as the last major attempt at peace, Bill Clinton's peace plan. People say that, you know, oh, it was a very generous offer and Palestinians should have accepted it. Why did that break down, if there is a concise way of putting that?
Well, both sides accepted the print that were called the Clinton parameters. Both sides accepted them with reservations. And even though the Israeli reservations have never been published, they consisted of, according to the accounts of participants, the Israeli participants, there were 20 pages, single-spaced pages of reservations. And as William Quandt, one of the leading diplomats in the Israel-Palestine conflict, as he once told me, because he did manage to read those 20 pages, single-spaced reservations, and he said it's hard to figure how anyone could say that the Palestinian reservations were any more stringent than the Israeli reservations. So they both sides accepted the Clinton parameters with reservations. And then talks were resumed at Taba in January 2001. And after Ehud Barak lost the election to Ariel Sharon, he suspended the talks. So the talks were terminated not by the Palestinian representatives, but by the Israeli representatives.
And, because I know we don't have that much time left, but getting to today, we have people in Congress like Ilhan Omar, and she supports BDS. Do you
I don't think see that's
that?
Technically correct.
Okay.
Because Ilhan Omar has stated very clearly that she supports a two-state settlement of the conflict. And the BDS movement has been very careful in its statement of principles not to recognize the state of Israel. So Ilhan Omar has not been ambiguous. One second. Ilhan Omar has not been ambiguous regarding her position on Israel. She has supported a two-state settlement, and that to me is not easily reconcilable with the BDS position.
Do you, that's interesting though, do you feel like the, because in my view, whether or not you think the founding of Israel is legitimate, there's no way it's going to disappear. Do you think that the, what is behind the refusal to recognize Israel? Do you think that that's like a smart strategic position?
Well, I think it's a lot of things, and some of them, in my opinion, are legitimate. I disagree with them, but I think they're legitimate. A large number of people take as their model the... One second, I just have to check this.
You can
take as their model the civil rights movement in the United States or the anti-apartheid movement. The goal or objective of both of those movements was equal citizenship within one state. And so there is the view that if these were exemplary movements of the past, then why shouldn't the same principles apply to the Israel-Palestine conflict? And why shouldn't there be one state with equal citizenship for everyone, which, after all, was the aspiration and the successful resolution both in the United States and in South Africa. And that seems to me a legitimate and wholly deserving of respect position. I have no problem with that. So that to me is fine. But there are also elements within the same movement which just don't think Israel has any legitimacy whatsoever, and that Palestine should be an Arab state. because it's located in the Arab world. It was Arab and Muslim for the overwhelming period of recorded history, and so they don't accept any legitimacy to having a Jewish state or Jewish dominance, or even to some extent a Jewish presence in the region. So I think there's a mixture of good and bad reasons, and some of it is just radical posturing, which I can understand because I was there at a certain point in my life. Some of it is a wholesome and admirable idealism. Why can't everybody just get along, as Rodney King famously said? So as I said, it's a mixture of some good reasons, some bad reasons. But I don't think politically they have any possibility of being realized any time in the foreseeable future.
Do you believe that moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem will cause any major changes?
No. No, I, okay. I don't see any. Donald Trump doesn't command enough moral authority that these fiats by him will prove enduring. My guess is if a Democrat gets elected in 2020, that's a big if, but if a Democrat gets elected in 2020, he or she will just resume the standard U.S. policy, and the Trump period will be looked at as some sort of weird aberration.
Interesting. Going back to Ilhan Omar, she had come under fire for some comments about AIPAC, that she said something like, it's all about the Benjamins, whatever. In other words, it's all about the Israel lobby. Is AIPAC really the problem here?
Yeah, I think AIPAC is a problem. AIPAC, broadly speaking, is a very powerful Jewish lobby, which has many elements in it. Not everybody is, so to speak, a card-carrying member of AIPAC, but AIPAC, broadly speaking, this Jewish lobby, pro-Israel lobby, which has had a very nefarious influence on American, not just American political life, but American cultural life, American social life. It's had a pernicious influence, corrupting our political system, corrupting our cultural life, and now having a hugely corrupting influence in college campuses and universities, where all sorts of efforts, all sorts of initiatives have been taken to stifle basic principles of free speech. They're extending now to state legislatures, which are passing these initiatives as well. And so the Israel lobby, broadly speaking, has become, as in my opinion, a pernicious influence in American life, not just at the foreign policy level, namely U.S. support, critical U.S. support for Israel, but on the domestic level, corrupting our principles of free speech, right to dissent, and all the rest.
Could you, it's interesting, because especially a lot of conservative people, or right-wing people, like to talk about free speech on campus, and you know, I'm not in favor of people being, their speaking events being shut down or anything like that, because I'm sure some version of that has happened to you as well. But there is a lot, when it talks about free speech on campus, there's a lot of harassment of pro-Palestinian activists on campus. Like, have you heard of Canary Mission?
Yes, I'm familiar with all of the machinations of these creeps.
Could you talk a little about that, because some people might not know at all what you're talking about?
I do think it's true now that on many college campuses there are initiatives being taken under the name of quote unquote Jews don't feel comfortable with this and Jews don't feel comfortable with that, to trying to stifle eminently legitimate debate and discussion about Israeli policy, and professors coming under fire, and a lot of people feeling genuinely fearful for their careers and their jobs if they speak out on Israel and Palestine. We're going to have to leave it there because I have to head out the door.
It was a pleasure talking, and keep. I don't have to tell you, but obviously keep fighting the good fight.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, bye bye. All right, what did we learn here today? Is it better to tell the truth or keep your mouth shut and be happy? I don't know, but thank you to Norman Finkelstein, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.